became old enough to drink. I certainly got stuck into it, got into drugs and alcohol. It was at the end of the 60s when I was 18, and LSD was the thing then. So I'd played around with LSD, and during one of those LSD trips I had an experience of dying, and part of that experience was seeing my life flash before me and slow motion for the more important decisions I'd made, and the end result of that was that I saw that I'd lived my life selfishly.
And grew up in Perth, and I went to a Catholic school, Aquinas College, where I generally speaking, I had enjoyed my time there, I had a good time in that school. But as I sort of came into my, I guess, adolescent years, 14, 15 or so, I became very interested in science. I became very interested in things like the theory of relativity. I found that quite mind-blowing, the idea that you change your perspective, you change your speed or where you are in the universe, and then somehow things change around you. The idea that that the world operates according to these very logical but at the same time very counterintuitive laws. I found this is something which is quite extraordinary. And at the same time, I found that the religion that I was being taught in my religion class was very, I found it very small. I didn't think that there was anything, it seemed to be very limited, very small, and didn't seem to address a lot of the questions and the issues that I found to be the most interesting. So I went through a process of inquiry and so on, and I eventually started to give up my religion. Catholicism at the time, but at the same time, one of the things that puzzled me the most was that I couldn't understand how people would believe in a religion, believe in something that was really true, and yet not live their life according to that. I found it difficult to believe these people really think that there's a heaven and a hell, and yet they still keep on doing all of these bad things. They really believe that there's a God who wants them to do this, and yet they do that. And so after some, I felt that if I ever did find a path or a religion that I felt was very true and very meaningful, that it had to be something that I would be willing to devote myself to 100%. Anyway, after finishing that, finished my school, went to university, UWA, studied philosophy and literature. And my main purpose to go there was to try to find out what I wanted to do with my life. I find it very bizarre that kids who are like 16 or 17 are somehow expected to know what they're going to want to do for the rest of their life. I certainly didn't. So I went to university to try to find out something more about what life was about, what I wanted to do. And I found it very valuable. I found the philosophy course very valuable. But at the same time, I also felt that everything was kind of second hand. I didn't feel that there was like a genuine, sort of a genuine real inquiry into the truth and into something which was a real and direct experience. I wanted to do something for myself, not just sort of repeat or copy what other people had done. So after a couple of years of doing that, when I finished my degree, I left uni, went and joined a rock and roll band. We played rock and roll for 6 years, something like that. I was a professional musician. I had a band called Martha's Vineyard. You can find a couple of our clips on YouTube if you're interested. And once again, I found it a very valuable experience playing both with Martha's and with different other bands that we had. I learned a lot. You got to meet some very interesting people, do some crazy things. But at the end of the day, also I found it to be somewhat limited. And so I reached a point where I guess I was a bit depressed, a bit lost. I didn't know what to do. For some reason, I don't really know why, but for some reason I had the idea or the plan to go to Thailand. And so basically to leave everything behind, my friends, my girlfriend, and so I left behind everything, left behind my guitars, my girlfriend, my friends, and I went to Thailand for to travel around and just experience something new. My plan, as a musician, I had very little money, so I managed to scrape together $1,000. And I planned to live in Thailand for a year on $1,000, which in fact I ended up doing, so that was pretty good. When I got to Thailand, of course, Buddhism is everywhere, and I was very lucky that I was in Chiang Mai, and there they had a retreat center where I went along and did my first retreat. And I think, you know, why did I do that retreat? Well, it was kind of the thing to do. Lots of people were doing retreats, and again, it wasn't like I felt like I had to be a Buddhist or anything like that, but it's just like, you know, it seems to be an interesting thing to do. So I did the retreat, which is very intensive, month-long Vipassana retreat, and at the end of that, I knew this was what I wanted to do. I didn't know how I wanted to do it, but I knew that something had opened up, that I learned something about myself that was irreplaceable. And when I came out of the retreat, I spent some time reading a few books and so on, and then I read a few Dhamma books by different people, and to be honest, I found them a little bit boring, wasn't that excited by them. And then I read someone pointed me to the suttas, and I started reading the suttas, and then I fell in love all over again. And so from that time, the two things that really inspired me in my practice, my journey, have been my love of the suttas and the meditation practice. So following that, I travelled around Thailand and Malaysia for a year or so doing this and that, and I ended up at Wat Nanachan, a monastery for Western monastics, and I stayed there, I liked it, and I ended up ordaining there and spent a number of years staying there and in different branch monasteries. And so the experience in the forest tradition in Thailand was invaluable for me. Looking back, I think that there were, that sense of joy and inspiration and energy that I had was sort of carrying me through a lot of difficulties. I wouldn't necessarily do it the same way again, but then, hindsight is 20/20, as they say. So I practiced and I learned how to be a monk. I learned how to wear the robes and how to what was expected, what was the ethics and behaviour of being a monastic monk, and I found a way that I could live where I could be of benefit to myself, again mainly through studying the suttas and through meditating, but also where I could be supportive and helpful to others in the community. After a number of years practicing in Thailand, I ended up doing my knees in quite badly from all sitting meditation and so on. And so I came back to Australia on crutches after my third brain surgery, and I ended up having an operation. Actually, I had two operations on my knees. I stayed at Bodhinyana with Ajahn Brahman, and as soon as I came here, it was very much like coming home. I mean, Perth is my home, my hometown, but I just felt a sense of connection with Ajahn Brahman, with the monastery. So that was something which was also very inspiring to me. And he was somebody who seemed to be able to take the teachings that I was reading about in the suttas and to be able to apply them and make them come to life in this very non-traditional setting. So since then, I've done a number of different things, and one of the things which is important to me is that my spiritual practice be not just relevant for myself, but that I have some way of engaging and speaking and using my voice, hopefully a voice with some Dhamma in it, to try to help those around me, especially to help people who are disadvantaged, who don't have a voice, people who are suffering, and not just people, animals, the environment. And so I believe that Buddhism, that the voice of the Dhamma, is something which can contribute a lot to the world that we live in today. And I hope that I've played some kind of small part in articulating Buddhist values and ideas in that way. And that's something I find personally is very supportive and very meaningful for me as well.
Bhante, you have authored so many books and you are embarking on a special assignment. Could you share something?
Yeah, well, I'm one of the limitations we have with such a project as a settle is that there's no complete and freely available translation of the main early Buddhist texts that we call the Four Nikayas in Pali. There are translations of them, but they're either old or they're not very good or they are restricted under copyright. So we can't make them freely available. And I think that's not a very good situation. I think it's a bit crazy that for Buddhism as one of the world's major religions that we don't have a freely available and high quality set of translations of our scriptures available for anybody who wants to read them. So having exhausted various other options in trying to make this happen, I decided at the end of the day the only way to do it was to do it myself. So I've now, from a bit later on this year, from what is it, August 2015, I'm going to be taking a translation retreat where for, I'm guessing, around 18 months, I'm going to be more or less just doing translation from Pali to English with the aim to produce complete new translations of the Four Nikayas. And these translations will be made available free of copyright, so anybody can do anything they like with them. That's how the Buddha did things. He never tried to control his words or anything like that. And also it will be done in, as much as possible, in plain English, so that it's to try to make them accessible for people who are not experts or scholars.
You're going to do it in solitude. Where are you going to do it?
I'm planning to be, I'll be staying on a little island called Chimeng, which is off the coast of Taiwan, and I'll be supported by some of my long-term guardians there.
Thank you.
Well, I started as a out at university here. And that was the first time I came across some like spiritual teachings. I started reading a little bit about Hinduism, a little bit about Buddhism. But the real breakthrough in my path to becoming a Buddhist was when I got the chance to go to Asia when I was at university. I was still studying engineering in Norway. And somebody said they had this exchange program. And they said they had an opening to go to Japan. So I thought, wow, I'd really want to go to Japan. And all my life I had this interest, this desire to go to Asia for some reason. It was very, very strange. And then when I eventually went to Japan, I stayed there for about 5 weeks altogether. Of course I went around, I saw the Buddhist temple, I saw some of the large Buddha statues, and some of the ancient Buddhist heritage of Japan. And also I read my first book on Buddhism. And that was, of course, an eye-opener when I read that. The strange thing about these kind of things is that you go there, and you recognize something. You see that there's something here that I recognize. You don't know where it's from. Right? When I went to Japan, I didn't have any Asian friends. I didn't have anybody who was Buddhist who were my friends. My family certainly wasn't Buddhist. And everything was kind of, it was coming from somewhere else. And for me, that was one of those great eye-openers in life. When I, looking back on this now, trying to understand why I wanted to go to Japan, why I wanted to go to Asia. And the only explanation I have for it now is that it must come from my past life somewhere. And that was one of the things that I recognized later on at the time, but I couldn't really explain why I wanted to do these things. And then after going to Asia, I came back to Norway again, continuing my years at university. And then one of my friends came up to me and said, here is a book on meditation. Read this book. It's a really, really nice book about meditation practice. So I read this book, and of course this book was called The Calm Technique, and it was a book about breath meditation, and I started to try out the breath meditation, and it had some nice results, right? When you have some nice results, it changes everything. And later in life, when I wasn't quite so happy, I was studying finance in London at the time, after my engineering studies, and I realized I wasn't really happy or content with what I was doing. There was something very, to me, a bit superficial and a bit... unsatisfying about the way that people were going about their lives who were studying whatever they were studying basically, but certainly also in the finance circles that was the case. And so I decided at that point to go to a Buddhist monastery and check it out. And that was kind of the point of no return for me. So I am very convinced to the present day that there's something in the past, that drove my interest in going to Asia in the first place, that drove my interest in checking out the Buddhist texts. And that was actually the kind of the trigger that enabled me to go down on this path. And then when I eventually became a monastic, I started off in England at the Chitres Monastery in England, and then moving on to Australia about 21 years ago now. And after starting to read the Buddhist texts, understand the Buddhist texts, that's when I started to understand the profundity of the Buddhist teachings. And what I started to realize very slowly is that these teachings, and this is where I started really to commit to Buddhist, the life of a Buddhist monk and the life of a Buddhist in general, I started to understand that these teachings, they are an answer to the most fundamental questions of human existence. They are the answer to the question of what is the meaning of life. And once you realize that you have found the answer to the meaning of life, then your search has to stop. You know that what you're doing now is really, this is really what it's all about. There's no further to look yet, and this is what you have to do. And then you have to just make sure that you commit yourself and that you pursue that practice with full integrity. And then also to be able to read the results of the practice, and to actually find that fulfillment and actually to discover that meaning of life for yourself. Thank you.
My name is Venerable Nisarana. I'm one of the Buddhist monks who ordained at Bodhinyana Monastery, though I'm now living in Sri Lanka. I've been living in Sri Lanka for some time. And I've been asked to talk about how I came to ordain, and before I became a monk, I was a librarian, but I was involved with the Buddhist Society from about 1984, because I'd become interested in Buddhism, and I went to a meditation retreat run by the Tibetan Buddhist Society, and that was my introduction to Buddhism. And after that, I heard about the monks being Ajahn Jagra, Ajahn Brahm, being in North Perth. So I went to meet them and was very impressed indeed. And it resonated with me, when I met them. And I was very inspired, particularly at that time, by Ajahn Jagra, because he was the main monk at that time. And so what inspired me was that it was a very noble sort of life. And also this was an example. Ajahn Jagra and Ajahn Brahm were a good example for me, that encouraged me to think, yes, I could ordain, Because after a short time of meeting Buddhism, I was interested in meditation. I had already been interested in meditation, because I had done Tea meditation, yoga meditation, and had been involved with the Rajneesh people too. So there was already an interest in meditation. And so, like one of my teachers, Ayakema, the reason she said she became a Buddhist nun was because I wanted to be a professional. So for me too, I wanted to be full-time rather than a part-time meditator. Because I know, as most people find, it's difficult to maintain meditation practice and keep up your Dhamma practice in everyday life, because you're working, you've got many commitments and so on. So that inspired me, but it took me till 1994, and I went and stayed at the monastery for 6 months. In fact, before I went to the monastery, Ajahn Brahm said to me, I don't know if you want to come still, because Ajahn Jagra won't be here, he's on sabbatical. And I said, of course I want to come. So, and that was a very, very important experience for me, because Ajahn Brahm would teach the word of the Buddha during the rains retreat, which was the main reason for being there. And it was like hearing the teachings for the first time, in a way. It was really very, very important for me, actually. It really gave me a picture that I didn't have before. Even though I had been going to the Buddhist Society for 10 years, it really was quite remarkable. So after that, I decided I wanted to ordain, but I went back to work for 1995, and then came back to the monastery in 1996 and started as an Anagarika and then became a novice, and after that took full ordination. And now I have been a monk for 17 vassa, so it's been quite a while. And I say, you know, people always ask you, why does one ordain as a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun? And I always say, it's a mixture of things. You know, of course there's a dukkha that pushes you from behind. You know, we all have dukkha in our lives. And of course that's relationships, that's, you know, work, all sorts of reasons people have dukkha. There's lots of it. And then there's also sukha pulling us, and that's the inspiration, you know, the encouragement, the search for happiness, which is what everyone is looking for, search for happiness. And meaning, very important for me was meaning too. And the Buddha's teaching always, you know, when I read it, it made so much sense. And I think that's what resonates with most people. They read it and think, this is reasonable. You know, I can understand, I appreciate this, you know. So those are the main motivations, as I say, dukkha pushing, sukha pulling, you know. And I can say, you know, that the monk's life, the monastic life, and even, you know, the Buddhist lay life is a much happier life, because we have a perspective on reality that most people don't have. You know, most people expect a lot from life, and they always get disappointed. But if you have a realistic, what we could say, a realistic view, then life is as it is, and you can suffer less and enjoy it more, you appreciate it more. So they were the main reasons that I ordained, you know, dukkha and sukha.
Now, you have been in Sri Lanka for so many years, being nearly a forest monk.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us places and how rough the life is and how difficult it is?
Yeah, I can just mention briefly. I went to Sri Lanka in 2006 in June for the Vassa, just to see what it was like. And I spent that Vassa in Uduwatakeli in Kandy. And I enjoyed it very much there, actually. And had already made an arrangement to go to Burma. But after Burma, I was going to come back to Australia. But I really felt drawn to come back to Sri Lanka, so I came back to Sri Lanka and went to stay in another place near Kandy, Boluwata, near Peradeniya University, up in the mountains actually. And that was a very nice place, you know, it has kutis in the forest, it's even a little cold and very wet, but very, very quiet as well. Mm. And conditions, I thought, quite good actually. I stayed in a kuti that other monks had, quite famous monks had stayed in, Pal Oksaido had stayed there, and other monks. So that was another place I stayed in, it was 2007. 2008, I went and stayed at Nitrigala in the Saranwani with Venerable Dhammajiva, who's well known here in Perth because he comes to teach retreats, and he teaches in Sinhala as well as English. So I stayed there, and I really appreciate his teachings and His example is really an inspiration. I like it. And sense of humour too. He's a very good sense of humour. So I stayed there in 2008, and I came back to Australia for the rains retreat and went back in 2009. Then I went back to Nisaranawane and stayed there again, and stayed for the Wasa and left in 2010 to live on my own. And since 2010, I lived for 4 years in near Balangoda, in a kuti, a hut, in the forest. It's under a rock overhang, so some people call it a cave, in a beautiful place, you know, up on the mountain, overlooking the paddy fields below and mountains in the distance, and a stream next to the hut when it rains. So very nice place, and I would go for Bindapat every day. I go for Bindapat every day to the village. And so for 4 years I stayed there. And then for the last 9 months I've been staying in a monastery, actually, in the southeast of Sri Lanka. It's Ampara. And the monastery is called Kudumigala, quite a famous monastery with exceptionally old. It's 2,200 years old. And it's very beautiful, has many animals. The monks are very kind, and it has an energy that is, I think, very, very strong. Yes.
So you were just back here then?
Yes, just came back.
For how long?
Oh, just for 1 month. Just
and
for
you
month.
Went back again?
Yeah. Because
were you ordained here or ordained there?
I know, I've done here.
This is a film I'm doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The other thing is, you met that monk who stayed 40 years in the forest. Can you tell us
Yes, Venerable Nyan Dipa, I've met a number of occasions, because he, first in 2010, because he was having Dhamma Sakaccha in a monastery in the mountains, and he had for a few days. He was, you know, answering Dhamma questions for the monks and also for the lay people as well.
For
and
40 years the monk has been in the forest?
Yes. He's
by himself?
By himself, yeah. He is a, I say in Sri Lanka, he's an icon, actually. Because he's like a modern-day Mahakasapa. And so he's lived in the forest for these 40 years. He's comfortable at home in the forest. He's not at home in the cities. One monk said he's like the animals in the forest. They live there. That's their home. It's not, you know, the city.
How many times did you meet him?
I've met him a few times. 2010, 2011, and in 2014 he came to the area I usually live in, and he was sick. So he was last year. He was staying for a few months. And so we looked after him. I helped a little bit. And when he recovered his health, he went back to another place. You know. But he is famous because he started a group of monks in an area called Lagala, near Mangala. And those monks, they live in kutis very far apart, you know, hours walking, you know, 4 or 5 hours, some of them. And they're three-sided, three-walled kutis, so one wall isn't there. And so this is quite an unusual thing. But this is his, like, something that he does all the time.
From which country is he?
He's from Denmark, actually. He's Danish. Same as another quite famous monk in Sri Lanka, Venerable Metta-Vihari. He's also Danish. So he's very impressive, and he's impressive because the fact that he lives in the forest and meditates in the forest, but also his understanding of Dhamma. And he has all the suttas, he's written them out, he's got them in Pali, you know, and he's collected them all, he's taken all the repetitions out, so he's got them in a little book, and he can, you know, refer to it. He knows many of them by heart. And
where was he ordained?
He was ordained in Sri Lanka, was he ordained? Yes, in Sri Lanka, I think in the Vajrayana tradition, I think, yes.
40 years ago.
40 years ago, yeah, because he was connected with Polgastua.
Polgastua,
yes, he was at Polgastua, and he went for 9 years. He lived in Bundala, in a kuti in Bundala.
Always in the forest.
Which is where Venerable, it's quite famous actually, Nyanavira lived. Nyanavira Thera. Who is very famous in Sri Lanka and very famous in Buddhism, actually, in the West, probably more so. But yes, he's been living in the forest for. In fact, he said to one monk, he said that, I heard this, he said, if he'd stayed in a monastery, he probably would have disrobed, because he's very much a, you know, somebody who enjoys being on their own, and likes that life and nature. I mean, I asked him why three-walled kutis, you know, three-walled huts, because, you know, it's unusual. And he said, I thought he might have some, you know, quite unusual explanation. But he said, so I can see the forest.
Ah.
So you can see the forest. So that perception of forest is always there. You know, I thought he might say so you can confront your fears. You know, it's good for meditation because there are animals in these forests and snakes and whatnot. But he said no, because you can see the forest. So, so he is, you know, he's an exceptional inspiration for monks. You know, and we had a very nice Vesak with him in 2014, because we had the Vesak full moon night. When we chanted the Patimokkha,
yeah,
in the forest, not far from where I was staying, actually. Very beautiful place. And then Dhamma Sakaccha in the forest. And then the monk stayed in the forest for the night. Most of them stayed in Japan.
How old is this Danish monk?
He's now 70, so his health is a bit up and down because quite a few years ago now, probably almost 20, he was trampled by an elephant.
Trampled by an elephant?
Yes, on the upper thigh.
Elephant stepped on his leg.
Yes. No. He thinks it was a mistake because the elephant was unusual. It was on two. It was on back legs, and then he thinks it lost its balance and came down on him. Mm-hmm. And so he said he didn't think that he had intended that, but that's what happened.
He never recovered from that.
Yeah. So he was in hospital for a long time. Had an operation. But he has as a result, has a very bad limp, which doesn't help.
So he can walk
now? No, he can walk, and he's amazing, he does walk.
But he's crippled, like rheumatism,
No, he has had problems with his legs in the last year or two, yes. It is a problem, yes. So he's, very inspiring. Yeah.
What is the downside in living in solitude in forest?
Oh, the downside is... it's very good because the Buddha, first of all, the upside, the Buddha praised it as being, very beneficial for your practice to live on your own, because you live in nature, you see your own mind, you see what's going on in your own mind. You're not interacting with people, so then all your attention is really focused on what mental states are coming up for you, and you cannot blame it on other things, although you can blame it on monkeys, I guess. People get very angry with monkeys, that's for sure, and frustrated with them. But it's very good for practice because you see your mind, you see yourself much more clearly. The downside is that you can get stuck in your ways, you can lose perspective, You can stagnate if you're not living it correctly. Yeah, so it's very useful. I like a bit of both. So you live in a monastery, and you live on your own gourd. But just to live on your own all the time, I think some may find that very beneficial. I think, but for most, then it's a bit of balance is good, because when we live with other people, it gives us perspective and it gives feedback, actually. They're like mirrors. So, we can, however we view them is what actually is going on in our mind. So it's very useful to do that, have both. And that way I think you can grow. Ajahn Chah said that to live on your own, if you do it in the right way, he said it's the very best. If you do it in the wrong way, it's the very worst. so there we are. And Ajahn Chah, of course, that the tradition is very group focused. Mm-hmm. So he's coming from that perspective, But I think it is the best in the sense that the Buddha praised it, actually encouraged it. But obviously you need to be ready for it, a certain amount of development and meditation and insight as well, actually understand.
Why I became a monk? But I've been a monk four times, not just once. This is not the first time. I've been a monk thousands of times. Hundreds of thousands, maybe. Who knows? We remember being monks because we go to countries where we have been monks and we feel so at home, even though we may be in Burma, we may be in Thailand, we may be in Sri Lanka. We feel so at home. Why do we feel so at home? Why does it feel more at home than being in America where I was born? It's a very strange thing. So we feel very close to Buddhism. The first time I became a monk was in 1968. I was living in Montana, state of Montana in the U.S., in a hippie commune that was planning to have the first big rock concert. We had built a huge house with television code. We had put our international advertising up in Europe, and we were planning on, we had already invited the Grateful Dead, the Beatles, and other groups, music groups, and we were planning on inviting 1,000 people to come to our house and build their houses. We were going to give them building materials to build their own homes. And it would all be televised on U.S. television, and it would be the first live concert, and it would change America. That was the idea, to change America. At that time, I was also getting a Ph.D. in clinical psychology at the University of Montana in Missoula, and it was New Year's Eve, 1968. This is before the, it was before Woodstock. Maybe my years are wrong, but it was before Woodstock. So it had been the first big concert. And we were talking, it was in the evening, on New Year's Eve. I think we must have taken some acid, LSD, before we talked. And my friend who was running the commune, Daniel Egging, very interesting fellow, madman. But he told me about Buddhism. The first time I'd ever really heard anyone talk about Buddhism, he said there's a Zen teacher, his name was Suzuki Roshi, who was opened a monastery in Carmel Valley, California, called Tassajara, and that, he told me all about, you know, what it was to be a Zen monk and all this stuff, and, you know, what it was to be a Buddhist. And after he talked for about 15, 20 minutes, an hour maybe it was, it felt like a long time, but it maybe only 15 minutes, I felt, wow, I am a Buddhist. Not that he was talking about Buddhism, this is what I am. And I said, wow, I want to go to that monastery. And he said, yeah, when are you going to go? I said, tomorrow morning. And the next morning I left and went to the monastery. But before I went to the monastery, I had to go to the center in San Francisco, and I went to the center in San Francisco, and I had long, you know, very long braid down to my behind, and very long beard down to here, and I told them, I'm going to Tassajara. They said, no, you can't. You have to sit in the city center for a year before you can go. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm going. And they said, no, you can't go. I said, no, I'm going. And I actually went. So I did get to the monastery somehow, and in order to get into the monastery, you have to sit what is called Tongario. This is, you have to sit for 3 days, day and night. I mean, you know, you sleep in your little hut, but you have to sit there all day, and you eat there, and you go to the bathroom if you have to. And it was very cold in those days. They didn't have heater. It was the old Zendo at Tassajara. And the girl who was sitting next to me had been an experienced meditator, and she was doing it, so I thought, well, I could do it. I passed out once. Anyway, yeah, that was my first experience. You know, someone who doesn't know anything about Buddhism, going to a Zen monastery, sitting for 3 days, and then spending about a month there. Eventually, I became a monk in that monastery and lived there for 3 years until my teacher died. And then I left. And then other things happened. And then I was, I'm not going to tell you my life story, but yeah, then I was in Taiwan when I was, and someone introduced me to this monk who was a very, very famous monk, Guangqin Fosher, one of the most famous teachers in his generation in Taiwan. He was called the fruit monk. He just ate fruit and he was ready to die. They dry up when they at this point, they stop drinking and they stop eating and they just dry up, and they put them in a big urn, they cover the urn, and then they dry up and then they cover them with gold. Very interesting. So anyway, I went to see him, and he was ready to dry up, but he met me, and he said, well, I don't know what he said, because he was talking another dialect. I was talking Mandarin, he was talking another dialect. And so what happened was, I became a monk in that monastery. And during the ceremony, I didn't know what he had said, but he said something like, I would become the next abbot of that monastery to the other nuns and monks in the monastery. And when I finally heard about that, this was many months later, I left that monastery. I got married again, had Analia, had my daughter, who now is a nun in the women's monastery here in Perth, in Ishigana. And again, I seem to go from relationships into monasteries, or monasteries into relationships. But it usually it's because something happened in the monastery. But anyway, I left that. I went to, where did I go? I went to Burma and became a monk in Burma. How that happened. It's such a long, any one of these stories could be hours. But I'm telling you different stories because it's all nonsense, you know? Why we became monks. The important thing, I became a monk here, I could tell you that story too. But well, it's not important why we become monks. It's important how we stay monks. That's the important thing to really know. Because we become monks because we were confused or something. Something happens in our life or we're amazed at what happens when we come to a monastery. And so we have this imagination about what it is to be a monk. But we don't know anything about what it is to be a monk. And so people come and become monks and then they disrobe. I would say 1 in 50 make it in monastic life, or maybe 1 in 100 really make it in the monastic life. So how do we stay monks? That's really the important question, because we come out of sort of fear, madness, romantic ideas or whatever. How do we stay monks? That's the important question. It's a big burden. What you think is happiness, I think is suffering. What I think is suffering, you think is happiness. That's the difference between a monk and a lay person.
Okay. So I was raised in the Catholic faith. My mum, particularly being Catholic, had me going to Catholic schools. And up until the age of 16 or 17, I used to go to church pretty consistently, especially the fact that we would go to church not just on a Sunday, but we'd also go during the week to the early morning masses, so 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And as a part of that process, I eventually was an altar boy, so I had some affinity with the idea of wearing a dress, a particularly spiritual garb. So the transition in from like a white gown in the Catholic altar boy form to wearing a brown gown didn't seem to be too big a shift for me. But that was much later on. So after primary school and high school, after I basically got fed up with the church, so the belief in God, because a lot of things didn't seem very rational, I left that, not thinking about religion at all, just thinking it was mainly for mindless people who can't think for themselves. So as a result of that, I never sought out any religion after I'd left the church at 16 or 17 years of age, and then basically just went through life, went to high school, and then went to university. Was late for me when I was about 26 years of age. So in between leaving high school and going to uni, I was undertaking a lot of different jobs, plenty of different jobs, and I'd universally get sick of all of them. And then when I was at the university, part of the course in the university in the first year, where there's a unit called Australia Asia Pacific Studies, and during that particular course of study, which was only 6 months, there was a part of it was looking at the religions which are in Asia, and three religions in particular: Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism. And so for me, anything to do with God was pretty much the same. So Hinduism and Catholicism and these other theistic religions, they all seemed pretty much the same to me. But when I read about Buddhism, I looked at the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path in the 5-page summary, something very short. When I read those Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, I said, oh, that must be it. There's nothing which seems to explain how things are and explain why things happen so clearly as the Eightfold Path. So I was interested at that point in about Buddhism, but I didn't pursue it because I still had another couple of years to go for the completion of my university degree. And so when I had come to the end of my degree and I was doing some teaching at the university, a friend of mine who's a lecturer had given me an invitation to have lunch with the one of the editors on the movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, who was coming over from the States. And so I said, yeah, okay, sure, because to me it seemed like a good networking opportunity. So when we actually had lunch, I was watching and observing what she was eating, and I said, why is it that you're vegetarian? Is it a diet thing? And she says, I'm a Buddhist. I said, okay, that's interesting. I looked a little bit into Buddhism when I was at the university. And so as a result of that, she said, well, why don't you come to the temple that I'm staying in, and you can come and listen to one of the Dhamma talks there. So interestingly enough, I went along to the Dhamma talks, and this was in the Pure Land, Chinese Pure Land tradition, in the Mahayana faith or sect. And having listened to my first Dhamma talk was actually from a bhikkhuni, a nun, a Buddhist nun. And listened to that, I thought, oh, okay, that seems reasonable, that seems good. And then I started to look into the teachings, so looked at the literature, because I was still a little bit suspicious, having had that Catholic experience and having doubts about doctrines and dogma. So I thought, oh, okay, I'll just keep reading and I'll see if I can find any problems with the philosophy. I thought surely it will come. But the more I read, the more I found that the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path were an unshakable thing, something which I couldn't poke holes through like Swiss cheese in terms of logic. So having gone through that process, I then thought I would like to ordain. And this started the path of the ordination path for me, was there with the Pure Land tradition, with Master Ching Kung, who was there. And I asked, and he said he didn't do any more ordinations. So then I needed to look elsewhere. And then I started to explore a Vietnamese temple in Canberra, because I was in Queensland at that time. So having gone to Canberra and staying in a Vietnamese temple, I thought it would be good to watch the monks and the nuns to see how they lead their lives. Because I didn't want to get involved in some sort of strange cult or something like this. And as a result of that, I lived there, see what they're doing day to day. And then as a result of that, I became more and more comfortable with the Buddha's teaching. And then I eventually looked for a place where I could practice. And I really wanted to ordain. So it was lucky I was actually at the Vietnamese temple, and I found a talk from Ajahn Brahm, another friend who was working there and a volunteer who was working there. He actually gave me a talk, and he said, have you ever heard of this this teacher, Ajahn Brahm? And I said, no, I haven't heard. And so he gave me the talk. I listened to that, and as soon as I heard that talk, I said, this is the Dhamma that I'm after. And as a result of that, then I sought out a monastery nearby. You know, being Canberra, the closest one is Shanti Forest Monastery, just south of Sydney, where Bhante Sujato was staying. And as a result of that, I went to Shanti Forest Monastery, and that's where I started the ordination process proper by becoming a novice there, and that was in 2006. After that, I was a novice for about 7 months, and then I just roved and I went to Burma to practice in the Burmese tradition, and I practiced with a nun, San Lady Punkar, on a 3-month retreat. And after that, I took full ordination with the monastery in Paok. So the ordination took place in Mo Lamien. So I took a full ordination in Paok Forest Monastery, in the south of Burma, in Mon State. And that was in 2007. And since then, I've been a bhikkhu, a fully ordained monk. And I've travelled to different countries. I've been to Sri Lanka and stayed at Monastery of Forest Monastery in Sri Lanka. I've been to New Zealand and stayed in forest monasteries in New Zealand. I've also lived without being in a monastery. So in terms of living in houses which were about ready to fall down and be transported elsewhere, and living on pindapat, literally what I can collect on arms round in the middle of the streets or the towns. And I did that for a few weeks, maybe about a month or so. And it was really inspiring to see how when you have faith in the Dhamma, that people will come and support you. I mean, this took place in New Zealand. It wasn't in Asia, and New Zealand is not a Buddhist country, and people nevertheless found it in their hearts to give and to support. And it just shows you that there's that strong kindness and love out there in the world that we sometimes take for granted, or we don't think exists because we're fed too much negative information over the news and the media. So as a result of that that process, now I'm actually trying to set up a forest monastery in Melbourne, just outside of Melbourne, in a town called Newbury, near a town called Newbury. It's probably only 20 houses. I don't know if you would even call it a town, but at any rate, the place will be hopefully for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis to practice and stay, and there's also going to be places for lay people to come and practice and stay there as well.
You want to know what brought me to become a monk, and the prelude to that was why I became a Buddhist, and I suppose it's had to start with I was always interested in something. As far back as I can remember, I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in finding out what life was about, what whether there was a reason we were here, how to be happy. So, and that question stuck with me throughout my childhood. I can't remember a time when I didn't have those questions going through my mind. So when I became old enough to drink, I suddenly got stuck into it, got into drugs and alcohol. It was at the end of the 60s when I was 18, and LSD was the thing then. So I'd played around with LSD, and during one of those LSD trips I had an experience of dying, and part of that experience was seeing my life flash before me in slow motion for the more important decisions I'd made, and the end result of that was that I saw that I'd lived my life selfishly, without a real plan, and that at some stage or another I was really going to die have the same experience. And it was not a God that was doing any judging or anything. It was myself was reviewing my life with a bit of impartiality, as if I was a third party just seeing my life. So I come to the conclusion that I could live my life a lot better, and there was a lot to understand about life, and certainly my eyes were open. So from that time on, I was really earnest about getting my life together so that when I really did die, I was going to be able to not be regretful about what I'd done with my life. So with that in mind, I decided God must be in India, or truth must be in India, because he certainly wasn't in the Catholic Church. And years later, after lots of and what have you, I ended up in Western Australia and working in IT in a college and doing Ajahn Brahm's 9-day retreats, and got involved in Buddhism through Nala Mara. So the Friday nights I come along and listen and then disappear. Over a period of time I slowly got involved with the library and did one or two 9-day retreats every year, and eventually I guess while I was doing this, I was building a mobile home, and the mobile home was a sort of a lifelong dream. Especially a four-wheel drive one. I'd built a whole bunch of motorhomes over years. I didn't particularly like to live in houses. I preferred to live in something that had wheels, that was self-contained, so that I could move around freely. So with that in mind, I'd been living on a friend's property in an old bus that was converted as a mobile home. And so over a period of about 10 years, I'd been building this thing, and went to Kalgoorlie to earn some money, I'd stayed at the Bodhinyana monastery for one wasa, one ranger retreat, as a lay person. Had some ideas, vague ideas of ordaining then, but still had my dream to complete, which was finishing off this four-wheel drive motorhome. So went off to Kalgoorlie, stayed there for a few years, and finally completed this motorhome. And met a lovely lady who's now at Dhammasara Monastery as a laywoman. And together we thought we would travel Australia in this mobile home, and great, we're living the dream. So we set off from Kalgoorlie and ended up with some problems where we had to get the tyres adapted, which brought us to Byford, which was close to the monastery. So we said, oh, we'll drop in on Ajahn Brahm and say hello, pay our respects. So we did that. And he asked where we're staying. And we said, oh, we'll stay wherever we like, over at the lookout across the road from the monastery. And he invited us to stay at Jhana Grove in the old caravan park. So that's what we did. We stayed in the caravan park. And after a few months there, we realised, well, we've actually got what we want here. We've got the seclusion, we've got what we wanted to get out of a motorhome, to stay in nature, to be in a nice place, and to have nice people around us. So we actually found what we wanted without having to travel to the Kimberleys or go to Ayers Rock or anything like that. So we had quite an idyllic, you know, time there. But after another few months, I was disillusioned with even having realised that dream, which most people in Australia would love to have a mobile home, to have a nice partner. I still was not fulfilled, and that's what that realization is what brought me to make the decision to become a monk. And so, with that in mind, I approached Ajahn Brahm and became an Anagarika over at the monastery, and that was about 3 years ago now. So, and I think it was the best decision I've made.
Found Bodhinyana Monastery by accident. I have a Thai friend who has a daughter, and she went to the same school as my daughter, and we became friends through our daughters. And one day this Thai friend of mine, she said, why don't you come along to the temple? And he had a bootload of food, and I was gobsmacked. Why have you got all this food in your boot? So much food, you know. And she said, oh, this is for all the monks. And I'm like, wow, what, do you know them? No, I don't know them. And I thought, why are you giving all this food to these people you don't even know? You know, this is... you're crazy. You know, I thought, you're crazy giving all this. I know she's a generous person, but I thought, this is, I've never seen anything like this in Australia before, this kind of generosity. So yeah, we arrived here at Bodhinyana Monastery, and it was the hustle and bustle of all the people. It was probably a weekend, so there would have been a lot of people. And when we arrived, she took all the food out of the boot and put it on all the tables that are same as today. All the food is on the tables inside the kitchen and dining area. And then she showed me, oh, you've got to have this bowl of rice, and then the monks will come along and you can put some rice in their bowls. And I was like, oh, okay, all right. So I went and stood in the line with all the other people with all their bowls of rice. And when the monks came down and I was gobsmacked again, because they weren't Asian monks. These were all Westerners. And I thought, they just blew all of my stereotypes and ideas of what Buddhism was about out of the water. There's all these Western monks coming down the line, and Ajahn Brahm was there at the start. And it really just kind of, I was gobsmacked. So something, at the same time as that happened, something inside me really moved, and I must have had the thought, wow, if these Westerners can do this, then so can I. And it wasn't many years later that I decided to come to the monastery. It took quite a few years, but it was that point when I saw Ajahn Brahm and the other monks coming down the Bindabat line that, something inside me moved, and I just felt nice. And that moment, something, seed was planted. And then the next few years, I was quite inspired by this. So I had already, at that time, I'd already started meditation anyway, because of my dentist, who said, did you know you're grinding your teeth? You should practice meditation. So that's how I first got into meditation, was through my kind dentist in Rockingham. He said I should practice meditation, and it might stop me grinding my teeth. And at the time, I did know that I was pretty stressed out. I was living in a world where there was lots of expectations on a young man, family and work, and acquiring assets and houses and cars and fast cars and fast motorbikes. And it was all pretty tough. So meditation was starting to come into my life. And then over the next few years, I had more and more meditation practice. And then it came to 2010, there was quite a big change where my daughter decided to go and live with her mother, which was a long way away. So it left me really not as an active father anymore. So that gave me the opportunity to work out if maybe becoming a monk would be a good idea. So I decided, and I talked to my daughter and my parents, and I thought I wouldn't give this a go. So once my daughter had decided to go and live with her mum at the top of Western Australia, very long way away, I went about preparing, selling all my assets and what have you, and paying off all my debts, coming to the monastery and giving it a go. It's a fantastic lifestyle. I don't know why more men don't become monks. I don't know if I've exactly answered why, but these were the events leading up to why I became a monk. But there are many reasons why, and some people say you have a balance of suffering and a balance of happiness in your life. You get the happiness from the meditation, and you have the suffering from life. So you're pushed by the suffering in your life to want to practice deeper, and the happiness you're getting from meditation and keeping precepts is pulling you into the meditation.
I was brought up in a country town in the southwest of Western Australia, in Pemberton. I'm an apple orchard in a Christian family. And so I really started life with a very kind of spiritual upbringing. And it wasn't really until my teens
then I started to kind of question my spirituality a bit more, and start to change from Christianity to more kind of looking at Eastern religions and all sorts of different societies. And a lot of that was my mother was quite sick when I was growing up, and then ended up with meningitis to the brain when I was about 13, and so she was kind of not able to form new memories, and ended up in a nursing home. So seeing somebody that you love kind of not able to function as people usually do. So that was one thing, having kind of a deeply traumatic experience where I was kind of running away from my problems. So I was involved with like alcohol and drugs and these kinds of things. And I met a really good teacher from India who was kind of like an Anagarika, like a person in white, a preceptor. At the time, the first retreat that I went to was, at the time it was the English monk Venerable Amaranatha, who's now destroyed, but he was doing a retreat in the bush, up in Dwellingham. And so that was really my introduction to meditation. The first time I meditated was when I was about 13, and then within a month also Dajahn Brahmada split the retreat. And you know, sometimes there was some peace, and other times it felt like putting a lion in a cage. But it was a start. And then I also joined up a yoga teacher who was the niece of the long-term paid preceptor I spoke about earlier. And I remember going back to my grandparents after that and still kind of charged from this meditation and writing down, you know, that's what life's about, and you know, forget everything else. You know, this peace and everything is where it's at. And still going to the Kalyana Mitra group, I then got a job at the at the Australian Submarine Corporation. So then I was actually working two jobs. I was very, very busy. So it was interesting to see at that point I started listening to lots of Ajahn Brahm talks. And so it was basically rather than watching TV and doing other things, when I wasn't working, I was usually listening to talks. So doing that, you start to kind of such a good teacher who was very accepting. I was amazed to see that the Buddhist Society of Western Australia was here. And having Ajahn Brahm and the other monks who were coming along was a bit of inspiration. Even just being involved with this community, coming along on a Friday night and having a cup of tea afterwards and a chat with people. And it wasn't long. I went on some retreat, Switzerland retreat. And before long I was involved with volunteering, helping out with the gardens of Chandra, with a lady, Mary, who is no longer doing it here, but we became very good friends. And before long my work would actually let me have every... Eventually I booked a 2-week retreat at the... monastery, like a holiday, to put my name down on the Anagarika list, if I could become
America. And usually, you know, just a waiting list can take 6 months or so, or a year for an Australian to kind of get to go there. And there's just been a cancellation, so after I drove around, I said, yeah, she said, yes, but you can come and visit this spot in 1 week. And for the start of the rain, she didn't welcome to come then. And I said, well, I better just think about it. And about 3 hours later, I said, yes. But now I was such an accepting monastery. And it doesn't matter your background or where you're from or anything, as long as you're kind of coming there with good intentions and a willingness to learn and practice, then you're accepted, which is a lovely thing. And since then there's no Garika, it still took me 6 months or more to actually sort out my stuff. Having a good monastery, having a good community where people get along and support you in the practice, and having a good lay community that's very involved with not only supporting the monks but actively in supporting the community as Ajahn Sujata's talk last night showed that, you know, for rights of women and rights of the gay community and all of these groups that as Buddhists were kind of